The next case is 001067, James Barbaric versus Catholic Diocese of Cleveland. Ms. Johnson. Can you speak up just a little? I think we're going to have difficulty. Good.
Is that better?
It's better.
Great, thank you. I think most of what I have to say in this case has been set forth in my brief. So what I'm going to try to do right now is summarize what I think really can be crystallized from the brief on both sides, and then make myself available for any questions you may have that haven't been addressed by either of the parties. The way I see this case at this point is one in which we have two main questions that need to be addressed by this court. One is whether there is a constitutional right to privacy with respect to one's status as a victim, as a child of sexual abuse. And second, if there is such a right, does a discovery order that affects that right fall within the scope of RC 2505.02 as it presently stands?
In that the court I believe this court declined to order a stay in this case at some point. Am I right? Am I thinking of the right case?
Yes, yes.
And so has the case been tried? And in light of the fact that we didn't stay the proceedings, is this case rendered moot by what has happened in the interim?
Practically speaking, no, because nothing's happened in the interim.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for asking. There has been no progress at this point on either the trying the case or any further discovery. Where we stand now is pretty much where things were at.
Am I correct that the only request that was made by the appellee in this case was for the names and addresses of all witnesses in the case? Is that correct?
That is correct. But this is why it's important for me, I think, to talk a little bit about the underlying facts. As this court probably was looking at the facts, this is a case where Mr. Barbaric alleges that he was abused by priests as a child while attending parish school. When the defendants in this case ask for witnesses, from a practical standpoint, what they are asking for are the names of other children who were present at the time that events at issue occurred. If there were adult witnesses, this wouldn't be a problem. If there were adult witnesses who were not, at least in the eyes of Mr. Barbaric victims themselves, there would be no problem here. The problem is that the people that Mr. Barbaric would be identifying as witnesses are people whom Mr. Barbaric has good reason to believe were witnesses because they were victims as well, they were present for the events.
Isn't that the kind of quandary, though, that is present in other cases to different degrees? You know, when an individual decides that litigation is a remedy they want to pursue, they always have to assess who will be drawn in, you know, members of the family, those sort of issues. I'm not sure are unique. I mean, maybe the circumstances are more pressing here, but that's not particularly unique to litigation, is it?
What's unique here is the interests that these other parties have with respect to being identified as not as witnesses to what occurred, what happened to Mr. Barbaric, but because of the unique circumstances here, being identified through that as victims themselves.
But to do what you want us to do in this case, we would have to carve out an exception to the discovery rule. Normally, witnesses' names are discoverable. I mean, I guess that's why you want to talk about the underlying facts, but we would have to create an exception.
That, I think, the issue that you raise right now is an issue that I think is one that the Court of Appeals should be developing on the merits. The question before this court right now is whether we are entitled at this juncture in the underlying proceedings to seek appellate review of whether the trial court's order with respect to Diocese's motion to compel.
That's really all that's before us. This is a final appealable order case, isn't
correct.
It? Correct. Anything to do with the merits or who saw what?
Correct. And the merits are an issue that we were trying to get the Court of Appeals to consider. We're at the threshold issue right now, which is whether we have an interim. The basic idea of whether there is a right here that somebody may have.
But you have to pass that threshold.
Correct.
To show that this is privileged matter in order to fall within the exception.
Whether it's a matter that a party might be affected by the order has a confidentiality interest
that's
subject
right.
to some legally
that cognizable falls within 2505 this is privileged matter, and how in the world are names of witnesses privileged matter?
Here's the question, the way this needs to be framed, I think. The names of witnesses are not normally privileged matter, but as I think has been recognized by prior courts, we had to deal with similar situations when litigants were looking for the names of, for instance, blood donors in the tainted blood cases that went through in the 1980s, for the most part, in the early 1990s, where plaintiffs in those cases were looking for the names of donors. And this is exactly the situation that was going on in the Court of Appeals case of Doe versus University of Cincinnati, where the plaintiff was a person who had received blood that ultimately left her infected with the HIV virus. She brought suit against the blood processing, the hospital and other entities, alleging that negligence in the processing and screening of blood donors and what they're bringing in was the cause of her harm. And she specifically sought the name of the donor whose blood she had received for the express purpose, as she stated, of talking to that person about exactly how he or she was treated during the process, stating to the trial court that that person would be a person who would know what the screening process was as to him or her. The Court of Appeals looked at that and said, well, yes, that could possibly be relevant. The problem we have here, according to the Court of Appeals, was that the disclosure of this person's name to the litigant is by definition a disclosure of that person's status as being HIV positive, and that person had a right to control whether that disclosure was made or not, regardless of whether the fact there was a third-party litigant who'd come in alleging claims or defenses that depended on what that person knew. And then what the court, after recognizing that right that could be adversely affected through the disclosure, even though it was going on in the context of the discovery, the court then went on to the merits to determine whether there was an interest that the party seeking the information had that outweighed that right. We're not at that point yet in this litigation. We're not at that point yet in this appellate procedure. What we're trying to figure out right now is whether there's an interest that is implicated by the court's discovery order.
Except if you do that, and I'll tell you my problem with the case, that this is just a discovery order.
Correct.
And don't you then turn all discovery matters into final appealable orders. And I know your response is going to be, no, there's a special interest here that's protected. But people in lawsuits are going to claim that all the time and go all the way through the appellate procedure and hamstring the trial of these cases. Not just this case, but even every personal injury case. It's privileged. The doctor's testimony is privileged. So we better go all the way to the Supreme Court and test that. And that's what we're getting into if we make final and appealable any discovery order.
Well, I'd like to note that even if you take the diocese reading of this, if there's an allegation that the order implicates a statutory privilege, then you are going up one way or the other. That's what the statute says. What I'm saying
seems that that would be raised at the next level, you know, that someone, your client, discloses the names to prove his case. He's got names of people he thinks would have information. Then it is, isn't it their privilege? It isn't they who would then have the next step when they're subpoenaed, then they move to quash or...
The problem that we have here is that their interest is in being identified at all. And I do realize that the diocese has raised the issue of standing, and this is one that I would like to address at this point, because as far as standing is concerned, Mr. Barbaric certainly has an interest of his own to protect, because if he does not comply with the court's order, he obviously is going to be adversely affected. From a practical standpoint, the interests of the other people whose identities are at issue here would not be adequately protected if we waited to the point where subpoenas are issued, because at this point, they have no notice that they're going to be identified to any litigant at all, that they're going to be labeled by anybody in any court proceeding as having been a victim of childhood sexual abuse. They won't have the opportunity to come in and defend their interest in maintaining privacy with respect to that until they've already been subpoenaed and they're already identified through the compulsion of a court order. The harm is already done there.
The diocese's suggestion that you use John Doe does not satisfy that, apparently. They still have to come forward, I guess. That's your point.
That question gets to the merits. I think this is a critical issue to understand. Whether the trial court's order sufficiently protected the interest that I think even the trial court realized is here, is a question to be resolved on the merits. It's a question to be resolved on a full review of whether the trial court properly protected, properly weighed and balanced the concerns of all the parties who are involved.
Well, for purposes of the final appeal order law, though, we're concerned about whether someone is going to lose a right which they cannot get back in the final appeal of the case, and so if we don't even know whether these witnesses care whether their names are public, do we? It's Justice Cook stated from the brief of the appellee that there is a standing issue here. It seems to me that we don't they may not care if they're names are known. They're adults now, and
they may not care, just as there may be people who don't care if it's publicly known that they tested positive with HIV virus. It may very well be possible that there are people who don't care if people know that they are gay. That misses, I think, the critical point here, which is that these people have a right to control that information.
Well, counsel, following up on the chief's question, this seems like sort of an interesting puzzle, maybe a mind game, because in effect, your client is asserting somebody else's heretofore unrecognized privilege. Isn't that really what's going on? That you're saying they have a privilege against being disclosed, and we're going to assert that for them.
In response to that, I'd like to say two things. First, that even though there may not be a reported opinion out there that addresses exactly these facts, I'd like to point out that the privileges, not the privilege, but the right to privacy is not a new one here, and it's been articulated on very analogous
I'm not saying it's unimportant.
What I'm trying to say is that it's not bizarre. It's no more bizarre than that one would want to have control over whether somebody knew that they had been a rape victim as a child or an adult. We recognize culturally that there's a right to privacy with respect to whether one has been sexually victimized, the same way that we recognize that there are rights to privacy with respect to any number of things that are
right.
What I'm trying to say is that it's not exactly an unrecognized right. Now, second, on the issue of whether Mr. Barbaric is asserting, has standing to assert this right on behalf of others, there are two points that I think are very critical here. First off, we're talking about whether Mr. Barbaric has the right, essentially, to notify the trial court that there's a third-party interest that might be adversely affected through the course of discovery, and that the trial court has the power to take that into consideration under Rule 26C and issuing protective orders. Second, it's not that alien when you walk away from the rather unique facts here for courts to take into account, especially at the discovery level, the issues, the interests of third parties not present. In less, I guess, colorful cases, employers will often say that a litigant doesn't have a right to the names or records of employees, even though those employees may not be parties, those employees may not have been notified, and those employees may not have any statutory or even common law rights to privacy with respect to that information. The employer can step in and say, there's no reason to burden these people with contact, which is, I think, exactly what happened in the case of Fairfield Commons Condo Association, which I cited in my briefs. In any event, it appears that my time has expired.
Let me ask you, Ms. Johnson, it's been a while since I've done any trial practice. I'm going to ask you to help me understand this. Let's assume that the witnesses are discoverable. Their names are discoverable, and now there's a deposition or a trial, and witness A is asked, were you present when the alleged occurrence or occurrences happened between the priest and Mr. Barbaric, and the answer is yes. And the next question is, did the priest engage in any inappropriate conduct with you? Can the witness at that point refuse to answer that question on the basis that this is a privacy right that I have that I'm going to assert? Is that something that can be done or not?
I think under the case law that I've seen with respect to the scope of constitutional right to privacy, that a witness probably could raise that, especially if that witness were not a party and had not brought that into play and had not chosen to bring allegations on the basis of that. It would then be incumbent on the party seeking the information to go to the trial court and explain why his or her interest in having that information outweighed the third party's interest in not revealing it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Maher.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I think this court understands, this is a very preliminary portion of what this case is all about. And initially, I would like to say that I think that there are basically three reasons why Ohio Revised Code 2505.02 does not apply. First of all, I do not believe that this comes within the structure of a privilege because the privilege is unique to the individuals. So the privilege would have to be exercised by witnesses, and I'll try to come back and tell you how I think that could be done. Secondly, the immediate appeal is allowable only when the order in effect determines the action with respect to the provisional remedy. It seems to me that if, in fact, witnesses' names come up and there is a problem, that this is not a final order because the witnesses can go to the trial court and ask for certain protections that may be unique with respect to each separate individual case. And therefore, I don't believe this is a final order.
And that's normally how this would be done. This is nothing new. I'm sure it's done many times in cases where witnesses come forward and seek non-disclosure.
In this particular case, we had two meetings with the trial judge to deal with the situation as it related to this. One of which we were called in, one of which we wanted to see if we could get together and make some determination. The trial court accommodated us and had counsel in, and we talked about it. The third reason why I would assert that this is not a final appealable order is it talks about the appealing party would not be afforded a meaningful or effective remedy by an appeal following the final judgment. Well, I think that particular situation would not occur here precisely because when we start dealing with the witnesses, we have the ability to determine what to do and what not to do. And I assure the court that at no time did the defendant or appellees ask the question, do you know the name of anyone who else was ever abused by either or both of these defendant priests? That was not it at all. I think we need to look at the question, and I would like to look at the question.
Well, you haven't gotten that far, have you? And I mean, that certainly can't happen yet, can it, if you go forward?
Right. But initially, Judge, I think the court needs to understand that in this particular situation, the only thing that the appellant has asserted is that he believes such persons were also abused as children by priest defendants. I looked at the merit brief of the appellant, and I determined that there are six occasions when the word believe or some derivative is used, and the other one simply speaks to feels that they might have been. We don't even have sufficient knowledge and information with which to determine that that is a certainty such that there could be asserted any kind of a right of privacy. And I think that's important here. And until we know who the witnesses are and have an opportunity to ask questions of them, we don't know what they observed or whether there was some conversation with the plaintiffs, and we just don't know anything. And to be prevented from having the ability to learn facts and to find out what, if anything, a witness does or does not know, saw or didn't see, heard or didn't see, we're being prevented from having an appropriate opportunity to conclude discovery.
Counsel, again, because it's interesting, I don't know what helps us determine whether it's a final appealable order, but with respect to the posture, if the plaintiff appellant were successful in getting an order saying, no, you can't have this, does that then exclude those people from testimony at trial?
The answer is that if that were such an order, we would file a motion with the court to make such a determination. However, the problem I have with that is that there might be information that, number one, could be helpful to your colleague. And we need to know that in order to determine. On the other hand, there might be information to be made that might be of assistance to one or more of the defendants, which I think we have a right to obtain and learn about. But yes, we would attempt to have the court enter an order because you're not going to be able to.
There are possibilities that this is all a red herring. The suggestion that there are witnesses, but we don't want to disclose because of the harm that might bring to them. We call it just our bad experience. When in reality, there is nobody.
I do not know the answer to that, but I will say this.
If you thought there were a bunch of other undiscovered victims that you were prevented for privacy reasons from getting to, that would change your outlook on whether or not you ought to pay out.
Well, certainly, but, you know, the converse of this is true, too. What if it was myself on behalf of my client, the Diocese of Cleveland, or one of the other attorneys, or in any case, some school, church, organization that had some information that someone else knew something about it, come in and take the position that the appellant has taken in this case? And I can guarantee you that if our roles were reversed, the appellant would be in saying to this court, make them give us the names of people that have some information relating to our client. And I think that there is a danger here in terms of what is being asked by the appellant. But I want to go back to the question when we asked whether there were witnesses or not, and to my question on behalf of the Diocese of Cleveland, the answer was essentially twofold. Number one, that the appellant wanted to obtain consent of the witnesses, and number two, appellant wanted protection of their identities. Now, that took place months before the motion to compel was filed with the court. We never received any information, nor did the trial court, that any attempt was made to reach any of these people or anything else. The second part of it, dealing with protection of their identities, we concurred, was important. Out of a concern for the sensitivity of witnesses, and I've done this in many, many cases, we suggested to the trial court that it frame an order with appropriate protections and things like using pseudonyms to protect the anonymity, filing under seal, and we felt that those were appropriate protections in this initial part of it. I also honestly believe that if there's any witness who feels that he or she has something that needs to be protected, I honestly believe that the trial court would conduct a hearing, would review everything, and make whatever decision was
Now let's get to the final appeal order. Suggested, let's change the facts and make it that was not your position, and your position was disclose it as part of public record, and the judge agreed, even though you conjured up situations in which it could be harmful and inappropriate for disclosure, but change the posture of the defendant to one who says it's all got to be on the record, open and above board and out there. The judge buys into that. And that's the entry that goes on.
That's pretty funny.
Should that not fit? Or does that still not fit within what might be an appropriate final appeal board? Because implicit in what you've said is that you recognize some privacy interest. And my question would be, say the judge doesn't recognize a privacy interest that others might acknowledge exists. That final appeal board.
I think it potentially could, but I know what I would do in that situation, because I've been through some of these. I would work with counsel for the other side. I would file a motion to file anything and everything under seal. And I would certainly be very, very careful about it, only because I have had some experience and I know that it is important to be concerned about the sensitivities of other people in cases precisely like this. I would.
So your answer is this is not a final appeal order because it's all been handled appropriately and would be handled appropriately. But if that were not the case, it could be a final appeal order.
I would have to distinguish this. If it is a situation like this where an individual is saying, I want to protect the identities of other people who may or may not be witnesses, then I would say, I don't think that's a final appeal order. If an individual witness came into the court and said, I want a right of privacy, then the court would have to determine what it is that person is asking for, listen to arguments of both sides, and in my opinion, fashion some kind of an order that the judge feels is appropriate in that set of circumstances.
So if these witnesses were asserting it themselves and were denied, that could be a final appeal for
it. It could be, whether ultimately it would be.
But we have to, in order to follow up on Justice Plager's question, and especially appellant really didn't address 2505-02-4, well, either A or B, but in particular, it's a B. The appealing party would not be afforded a meaningful or effective remedy by an appeal following final judgment as to all proceeding issues claims. But what we've been focusing on here today, we see that there are all types of remedies prior to a final judgment in these instances with requests for discovery of witnesses' names. You've been addressing them.
Yes, that's precisely my point, that this is so preliminary at this point that it can hardly be said that simply identifying names of witnesses constitutes a final appeal.
I want to hear from the appellant and to see how this would ever comply with 4A or B.
That's my opinion precisely, Your Honor. And I just think that at this juncture, under Civil Rule 26B1, we have the right to ask for the identity of persons having knowledge of any discoverable matter. And it is a two-edged sword. It could go either way. The point is, I think in defending the case, we need to have as much information as is material and relevant in order to determine how to best prepare a defense and defend our clients. And it seems to me what they're asserting is this broad, all-encompassing blanket right of privacy that I think could have some very, very serious implications in terms of other types of cases, as well as cases of this nature where everybody begins to assert, oh, they have a right of privacy, and I'm not going to release that kind of information. I think that could really, really severely affect justice. So I feel that the Court of Appeals was correct in determining that this was not a final appealable order, and I don't think we need to get into the 54B argument. So unless there are any questions, I would conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Johnson, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address the question that Justice Resnick has put on the table. It is a very important one. And I think the answer can be found by looking towards the federal cases dealing with the collateral order doctrine. I think that's something that the General Assembly was looking to when it framed these amendments to the statute. I think it took this court's clue when, in its footnote from the Walters case, when this court said, if you want to deal with this problem, there are two ways to deal with it. Perhaps the federal model, or perhaps you take another statutory approach. I think it's pretty clear from the parameters of the amendments to 2505.02 that the General Assembly was guided at least in part by the federal collateral order model. And under the federal collateral order model, discovery orders are reviewed, even though, as we all understand, there's always the opportunity for a court to readdress an interlocutory order. This 2505.02 was amended specifically so that when these interlocutory orders, but that yes, a court can go back to before a final judgment, can be reviewed when it appears that the interests that are affected are, under the circumstances, practically speaking, not going to be readdressed by the court, by the trial court, and if not addressed, a real risk of irreparable harm exists to some party affected by the order. And I think that's what's going on with the test and the requirements in 2505.02b, which I think are really the critical things that this court needs to look to in determining what constitutes a final appealable order under that provision of the statute. I think the problem that's been going on with the trial court, and I truly urge this court not to fall into that pit itself, is that when courts look to these amendments, they look first to to the list of examples in 2505-0283 rather than the general language. 2505-83 sets forth proceedings ancillary to an action, including but not limited to, those specific examples that are listed there. And then the statute states that an order that has to do with proceeding ancillary to an action, and that is by definition one that is going to be interlocutory more often than not.
You've used your time, Jen.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.